When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's The Ancients on History Hit. I'm Tristan Hughes, your host, and in today's podcast, where we're talking about this remarkable figure who emerges in the aftermath of the Romans leaving Britain in the 5th century AD or CE, a figure called Ambrosius Aurelianus, one of the key influences in the creation of the legendary figure that is King Arthur. I don't know if any of you have seen the 2000s movie, the King Arthur movie with Clive Owen, with Keira Knightley, with Mads Mikkelsen. Well, the basis for that King Arthur figure evidently does seem to be Ambrosius Aurelianus, this figure who emerges in the 5th century, who battles against the Saxons in the wake of the Romans leaving this distant island. Now, to talk through what we know about Ambrosius Aurelianus and the legacy of this figure, how he evolves, how he partly contributes to the creation of this figure of King Arthur, joining me to explain all, I was delighted to go and interview in person earlier this week Bournemouth University's Dr. Miles Russell. Miles, he's a hell of a character. He's a great laugh. It was wonderful to get him back on the podcast. He was on the pod last year to talk all about King Arthur and how he was this Celtic superhero moulded from 5 particular ancient figures, one of which is Ambrosius Aurelianus. Miles is back on the podcast, this time to explain all about this mysterious Ambrosius Aurelianus, what we know and how his legacy evolves over the following centuries. So without further ado, to talk all about Ambrosius Aurelianus and whether he was the real King Arthur, here's Miles. Miles, it's great to have you back on the podcast.
Tristan, it's good to be here.
And doing it in person, which is always a plus, in your office at Bournemouth University.
In the chaos of my office.
In the chaos of your office, I see, this is a classic archaeologist's office though, isn't it? I see just boxes everywhere. I see finds. This is the archaeologist's life, isn't it?
It is. I wish it wasn't quite as chaotic as this, but yes, yeah, you're in the middle of everything. A lot of things we actually found this summer, which we're processing and working on at the moment.
Well, there we go. Who knows? There'll be the next huge discovery announced from this room
one day,
from this very room indeed. We're talking about something a bit different today, though, aren't we? We're going back to post-Roman Britain. And this figure, Ambrosius Aurelianus, now, the legacy of this figure, from himself to Clive Owen in the early 2000s, I can't think of many other figures from this immediate post-Roman period in Britain that seem to be so well known, or at least have quite a bit of a, should we say, fame around them than this guy.
There aren't many people. Obviously, you know, we still refer to that time as the Dark Ages. There is quite a lack of reliable written sources anyway. So Ambrosius Aurelianus is one of those figures who really stands out. Of course, we've got Arthur, and most of the oxygen from discussion of the time is arguing whether he existed or not. But Ambrosius Aurelianus, we know, is there. He is fighting. He's one of a series of warlords there in the carnage of post-Roman Britain, trying to establish order and perhaps trying to survive, really. But he's one of the few that we know anything about.
And that's what's really interesting, isn't it? You mentioned Arthur, King Arthur, and it seems that Ambrosius Aurelianus plays a part in Arthur's story. But what you say there, I think, is so, so interesting, is the fact that this guy, he is a real historical figure in this time where, as you say, it's still shrouded even to this day
in quite a lot of mystery.
It is. And admittedly, you know, compared to Arthur, Ambrosius is far less well known. He's obviously not a huge household name, but you could say he's probably got more impact because we can trace what happens to Ambrosius afterwards. You know, he's got impact as far as the earliest English dynasties have got. He's got an impact culturally in Wales with the origins of the Welsh flag. He's even really looks as if he has got a significant impact on the creation of the Arthur story itself. So arguably he's got more significant impact than Arthur, or indeed quite a lot of period people from the Roman period right up into the Saxon and early medieval times.
Well, let's delve into this figure then, this really interesting figure. But let's go to the background first of all. 5th century AD or CE Britain, the Romans have gone. So what's the context when Ambrosius Aurelianus is living?
The period immediately after the collapse of the Roman administration is, I guess you could sort of point to more modern examples like the sort of democratic deficit collapse of society in Syria or Afghanistan, where you've got a series of warlords, you've got a fairly sort of bloody civil war. And from an outsider's perspective, it's very difficult to identify sides or to really see what's going on. We know that Rome pulls out of Britain in AD 410. Prior to that, there's been a series of rebellions. Britain is one of the most difficult and problematic of all Rome's provinces. There's a huge amount of military tied up in the province. It's so far away from the heart of the empire. It's separated by the English Channel as well. So it's a very difficult province to control. And we know in the last sort of 50 years of Roman administration in Britain, they're not controlling it very well. There's a series of rebellions. Some of these so-called emperors take soldiers out of Britain to attack the emperor in Rome. And by 410, the emperor Honorius in Rome has had enough and basically says to the Britons, sort yourselves out. I've got problems are far too pressing elsewhere. And effectively acknowledges the fact that the Britons have rebelled against Rome and they're not going to do anything about it. They're left to their own devices. Now, from that point of view, it's frustrating from a historical perspective because Roman writers, people in the Mediterranean, are no longer interested. We're not getting any information from Britain. So we hear lots about, say, the Visigoths in Italy, the Vandals in North Africa, the East and Western Empire fighting each other. But we don't hear much about what's going on in Britain. So as far as contemporary sources go, we're reliant on a very small number of written texts, most of which aren't written anything close to the time that they're describing, all from a religious perspective. So we've got an individual called Gildas, who's writing in about AD 540. It's about as close to the period as we've got. And he writes a religious polemic. It's a rant. It's a sermon about the corruption of his time. And he really gives us, you know, if we're trying to think of somebody who's really coloured our perspective on post-Roman Britain, it's Gildas, because it's all about Saxon, vicious Saxons, angry Britons, plague, pestilence, disease, you know, people with their togas on fire, towns burning down. It's real sort of blood and thunder stuff. But he presents it from the point of view that the Britons have strayed from the path of true Christianity. They've become corrupt. They've had, you know, orgies and parties and decadence. And he portrays the English, the Anglo-Saxons, the migrants coming into Britain as the scourge of God. They're a biblical plague sent to punish the Britons. That's his perspective. So it's difficult from his writings to really get a sense of what's going on. But he presents a world of chaos and confusion where there are multiple warlords, each as bad as the other, fighting one another, fighting the Saxons who are coming in. And that's really, from the historical text, that's the view that we get. You get the feeling that it's not a great time to be alive. And it may have been, for most majority of people, things may have been fine. If you're on the front line of any kind of conflict, obviously it's less great. But there's no central authority in Britain when the Romans have gone. There's no capital. There's no army maintaining order. So it is pretty much everyone for themselves. So we're seeing, a political picture that's fragmenting. People are in conflict. And so there probably is a lot of truth in what Gildas says about the political chaos of the times.
What strikes me is that the time when Gildas is writing, this is still 140 years after the Romans left. That's still a sizable amount of time that we have no sources from, almost, literary sources.
No, exactly. And sort of the peripheral references from the Roman world talk about Britons, the Britons are lost to Rome. They're under the control of the Saxons. And that's pretty much it. There are no useful sources for which we can reconstruct the past. So we rely heavily on archaeology. But in the last sort of the situation's changing more recently, but throughout the 20th century, we were very much coloured by Gildas's writings. And there was this view that the post-Roman period was chaotic and unpleasant and difficult. And so archaeology was presented as evidence for that. You know, archaeologists were looking for signs of violence on skeletal remains, signs of settlements burning down, signs of economic collapse, things that supported the narrative of this sort of religious fanatic Gildas. Excavations more recently have focused on the idea of there are quite a lot of settlements at the time. They seem quite prosperous. People are trading. So there is this other massive evidence that's giving us a better picture of the times. But if we're trying to find a historical text which gives us dates and a chronology and, you know, a kind of political idea of what's going on, there isn't one.
How Roman, from all the archaeology that people have been doing so far, what is our best bet as to how Roman Britain is at this time?
Britain is, well, if you go back to, about, I guess, 100 years before the Romans leave, you can say Britain isn't that Roman. It's an un-Roman province. There are obviously a large number of wealthy villas, but it's the rich, it's the powerful who are Roman, who are integrated into Roman lifestyle. When you go out away from the villas into the rural settlements, you'll see, yeah, I guess you could say peasant communities, people who are farming, subsistence levels. They haven't got a lot of access to Roman goods. They're almost excluded from that Roman lifestyle. So when we're talking about Roman culture, it's tied up with the hyper wealthy. And we look at Roman villas and think these are good examples of you know, what Roman life was like. But it'd be like looking at the 18th century and focusing just on stately homes. It gives you a completely warped view of what is going on. The wealthy leave a substantial footprint, but it's they who are invested in a Roman lifestyle. When you take them out of the picture, Britain is a very un-Roman province at all. So it's not a case of people defending their Romanness against the barbarians. It's people who, they're marked by 400 years of Roman occupation, but there's no incentive to be Roman or to live like the Romans or to preserve or to protect a Roman lifestyle.
Fair enough then. I mean, it's really interesting to kind of highlight that with, as you say, with how London seems to have been, well, abandoned after the Romans leave, you know, big Roman villa, all those Roman villas fall into disuse. But also in this period, post-Roman period, you have the emergence of a figure called Ambrosius Aurelianus, who it seems does have this Roman heritage that is highlighted.
Again, if we go back to Gildas, you know, who's writing in the 540s after the time of Ambrosius, Gildas is damning about every single person. You know, every leader, every church member, anyone inverted in the clergy is corrupt or sinful or depraved. The only person he's got a good word for is Ambrosius Aurelianus. He describes him as the last of the Romans, presumably somebody of a very wealthy background who's got their own private army. But whatever Ambrosius does, it's worthy of Gildas's praise. The only person in his entire narrative who does anything worthy. And he doesn't give us a lot of detail, but he says that his parents, very sort of euphemistic phrase, he says they were of the purple. It's emperors in the first and second centuries AD. Purple is such an expensive dye that they wear, have purple clothes, purple toga. Senators have purple stripes. So wearing the purple means that you are an emperor or a member of the imperial family. And he says that Ambrosius's parents were of the purple. So presumably they were an usurpers or they were general. They were someone high up in the infrastructure of Roman Britain. So he's inherited that sense perhaps of destiny. He's inserted that sense of having an army, of having military background. But that's really all we know about him, apart from the fact that he fights a battle against Saxons at Mount Badon, and it's portrayed as a dramatic victory, the enemy almost completely annihilated. It's a big sort of a victory over this barbarian horde, the like of which has never been seen before. So that's why Gildas gives him this sort of praise as a military genius who inflicts a crushing defeat on the enemy.
If we go back to Gildas quickly before going on to the Battle of Mount Badon, because I'd love you to explain in more detail what Ambrosius's supposed role in this battle. It does sound, therefore, that with the figure of Ambrosius Aurelianus, Gildas, is he our nearest, is he our, and I put a quote unquote, is he our best source
he's
for
our
this
only
figure?
Source.
He is our only proper
yeah.
source.
I mean, he says, the really other irritating thing about Gildas, he doesn't give us dates. The people he's writing for, his congregation, you know, he doesn't need to give dates because they're aware of what he's talking about. The only thing he says is the Battle of Mount Badon occurred 40 years ago. But given he doesn't tell us when he's writing, that's a fairly pointless, useless sort of a definition. So we're assuming Baden's about 500, Gildas is writing about 540. But there's no, he doesn't give us a list of battles, a list of events or dates. So he's our only surviving source from that. There may have been other sources which are since lost during the like, dissolution of the monasteries, where we know huge amounts of documents were burnt relating to the earliest religious activity in Britain. But he's the only material that's close to the period that we can rely on.
And so talk to me therefore about the Battle of Mount Badon in Gildas's account and the role of Ambrosius Aurelianus in it.
He cites Badon as the, sort of the crowning achievement of Ambrosius's reign. He calls it the Siege of Mount Badon. The annoying thing is there is we don't know who's besieging whom, but it's evidently one side is attacking the other. And we presume it's, by the sound of it, what later writers sort of describe, that it's probably the Saxons who are being besieged. But it's portrayed as a stunning victory. And it certainly resonates down through the generations, because later writers credit Badon to King Arthur. It becomes the crowning victory of Arthur's reign. So he sort of absorbs that particular campaign, that particular battle, and it becomes his crowning achievement. So it's obviously very, very important, but casualties, we don't know. We don't really know where it was fought, although most modern historians assume it's somewhere around the area of Bath, and it might be Badon, Bathon, Bath is that same sort of geographical placement. So we don't know much about, other than the fact it is a vital turning point in the post-Roman era, but anything else is really sort of guesswork.
In regards to vital turning points, you also mentioned how this seems to be the climax of Ambrosius Aurelianus's achievements from what Gildas is saying. How does Gildas therefore depict the rise of Ambrosius Aurelianus? Is it very much that he is, as we, let's say, we see in a rather recent film, King Arthur film with Clive Owen, this idea that he rallies the Britons, he unites them, he brings them together, and that a series of battles are fought against the Saxons, which ultimately culminates in the Battle of Mount Badon? Or do we just not have that detail available for Gildas?
We just don't have that detail. It's sort of Ambrosius emerges as the preeminent general and Badon is his crowning victory. And then Gildas goes off to rant about other people. So it's that sort of sense that there is a brief pause in his hatred of humanity where he describes this amazing achievement. And then we're back to...
So he doesn't go on to talk about what happens to Ambrosius Aurelianus after the battle, does he?
No, he doesn't.
So to look more into the life of Ambrosius Aurelianus, because it feels that Gildas is quite limited, where do we have to go?
Gildas is limited, but he provides a starting point. He's the keystone upon which all else is built. Our next really sort of major source is a difficult one. It's often ascribed to Nennius. Nennius, we don't actually really know if Nennius existed as a real person, but there's lots of writings called the Historia Britonum, the History of the Britons, which is a series of genealogies, praise poems, legendary events by different people, which are just sort of lumped into one big book. And Ambrosius's story appears in a more developed form there, but it's quite clear. I mean, this is written at some point, probably around this sort of 900s AD, this is written down. So it's a long, long time from the periods it's describing. And it's clear we've got a series of oral traditions, so spoken accounts, which Nennius or someone like him is bringing together. So a lot of stories contradict one another. Sometimes we get different accounts of the same people, but Ambrosius Aurelianus appears in there as what's been referred to by later writers as the dragon prophecy, which sounds nice and dramatic. Right. But essentially, we get an account whereby there is a leader of Britain, or the Britons, called Vortigern, who every source describes as a thoroughly bad hat. You know, he's somebody who's invited the Saxons in. He's been betrayed by them. He's had all his aristocrats murdered by them. And Vortigern flees to the distant part of his territory where he tries to build a castle. And this is where we get suddenly the legendary element coming in, the great sort of mythology. Somewhere, and it's assumed to be somewhere in North Wales, he's creating a castle to protect himself. The builders start. The next morning, all the building material is gone. They start again. Next morning, the building material is gone, and he can't actually create a defensive structure. And so he asks his advisors, what can we do about this? They say, you need to find a boy who has no father, a boy who's been a miraculous conception. Bring him here, cut his head off, sprinkle the blood on the site, you'll be fine. And eventually, to cut a long story short, his advisors find this young boy, and his mother claims she's never met a man, you know, she hasn't been in contact with anyone. So it's a miraculous birth. They bring him to the site, and just before they kill him, he says, what you need to do is to dig down into below the foundations, and you'll find a pool, basically a large sort of area. And they do that, and they find a tent in each corner of this subterranean pool. There's a white dragon or a white serpent and a red one. The two are fighting. The red one looks like it's going to win, but then the white one sort of backs the red one into a corner. And then finally the red one is eventually triumphant, and they sort of go, what the hell is this? What is going on? And the boy announces that he's called Ambrosius Aurelianus. He does actually have a father. His father is a Roman consul. So you know, there's two variant forms of that story. But he says, effectively, what you're seeing is the white dragon is the Saxons, the English, the red dragon are the Britons or the Welsh. And although the Saxons look like they're triumphant now, the red dragon will eventually defeat the white. And this becomes a major element in lots of Welsh mythologies. It becomes a major element that a lot of the princely dynasties of medieval Wales take on board. Llywelyn the Great takes on board as quite a major motif. And we see the development of the Welsh flag and the symbol of the red dragon coming from that story. Now, of course, we'd have no idea where this story originates from. But the fact we've got Ambrosius Aurelianus as a young man, you know, this is his earliest, it's sort of like his origin story, motivating the Britons, giving them something to fight for and giving this sense of destiny. Later accounts rewrite that and it becomes Ambrosius Merlin, and then it becomes Merlin. So the story of Merlin comes out of Ambrosius, but Nennius first credits this to Ambrosius. So Vortigern the bad king is replaced by Ambrosius the good king. And at the end of the story, we've got Ambrosius attacking Vortigern in his castle. The castle gets destroyed. The bad guy gets burnt with his entire army and Ambrosius takes power.
And so in that version, is there a comparative version to Mount Badon battle, therefore, or is it very much this clash against Vortigern?
In Nennius, this is the first time we see the name Arthur really emerging, because we get a list of Arthur's 12 great battles. Now, some of these battles are obviously repeated, so it's probably more like six great battles, of which the other six have been repeated, but Badon is in there. And it's the first time that Badon has been taken from Ambrosius and given to Arthur. Arthur's not credited as a king, he's the Duke of Battles. But it's the first time that we've seen Arthur as an individual being named. Now, the problem with Arthur, as we've been aware of, you know, for generations, is that Gildas doesn't mention him. Earlier source doesn't describe King Arthur. And there's an absence in his writings, which is either because Gildas hates Arthur, but I think he would have mentioned him and said what an awful person he is, because he does that to everyone. Or Arthur's been created from other great characters. And Ambrosius, because we know it's Ambrosius that fights Badon, and later Arthur is given that battle, that I think the Arthur story is a composite character, a large part of which is created from the real-life character of Ambrosius Aurelianus, who does fight Badon, who does get the Britons together, and who is seen as a great rallying force.
Hi there. I'm Kate Lister, sex historian and author. And I am the host of Betwixt the Sheets, the history of sex, scandal and society, a new podcast from History Hit. Join me as I root around the topics which have been skipped over in your school history lessons. Everything from the history of swearing to pubic hair, satanic panic, cults, there is nothing off limits. We'll be bed hopping around different time periods, from ancient civilizations to the Middle Ages to Renaissance and early modern, right up to now. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is After Dark, myths, misdeeds, and the paranormal.
The podcast that takes you to the shadiest corners of the past, unpicking history's spookiest, strangest, and most sinister stories. I'm Maddie Pelling.
And I'm Anthony Delaney. Join us every Monday and Thursday and we'll take a look at the darker side of history, from haunted pubs to Houdini to witch trials and arsenic-laced breakfasts.
Follow After Dark, Myths, Misdeeds and the Paranormal wherever you get your podcasts. Brought to you by History Hit.
And it is interesting, isn't it, if you mention that Nennius writing in the 10th century?
Yes.
10th century, and if Gildas...
Well, as close as we can guess.
As close as we can guess. And if Gildas is in the 6th century, and Gildas mentions Ambrosius Aurelianus then, even though the mentions of Ambrosius you don't hear in the centuries between, evidently the legacy of that figure does live on. So it's really interesting to try and piece together how his legacy has developed, has evolved by the time you get to Nennius, particularly in that Celtic, you know, the non-Saxon conquered part of Britain.
It is. I mean, it's really, in a way, it's exciting, but it's also frustrating, because we know when the character Geoffrey of Monmouth in the 1130s writes down a series of legends, he says a lot of these are oral stories that people have been telling for hundreds of years. And we know in, if we call it Celtic society, there is this oral tradition of storytelling, that stories are passed down by word of mouth. They don't write anything down. And the danger is there that we know that stories can last for hundreds, if not thousands of years, but they gradually change and they mutate and they develop into other things. So the stories of Ambrosius and later stories of Arthur are written down hundreds of years after they really happened. So they've mutated into something else. And getting back to the origins of the story is very difficult. But we can at least say when Gildas writes in 540, there is no Arthur. He appears later, and it might be that he's being created out of the story of Ambrosius Aurelianus.
Well, when you look at a figure therefore like Nennius, and we'll get on to Geoffrey of Monmouth in a bit too, I mean, how have you found it trying to see whether there is this element of truth, the basis of truth for the very much legendary figure of Arthur and also of Ambrosius Aurelianus by that time? Is there any way, by looking at Gildas's accounts and then looking at an account like Nennius and thinking, right, is there any basis of truth here in which I can look at Gildas's account, get an idea of this figure of Ambrosius Aurelianus from that, and then potentially learn a bit more of this figure away from the fantasy in later sources like Nennius?
It's very, very difficult. I mean, the problem is when we look at Nennius and we look at some of the later writings, there's things in it that are so obviously fantastical, like the whole serpent stories, the fighting dragons. This is obviously something really fantastical, really sort of, this couldn't have happened in a sense. There's so many of these kind of accounts that it's quite clear that when you get into the 8th, 9th centuries, the original stories of Ambrosius and what develops into Arthur have shifted completely, and that they are becoming more dramatic. You're having giants and dragons and magic being added to it. So to try and drill back down to the original stories is extremely difficult. We don't have a wealth of primary sources. And so using these later versions to try and create a story, I mean, it's worth doing, but you're never really going to get to the actual, I guess, solid truth of the original.
Incredibly difficult question, I know, fair enough. Well, let's go on. But before we go on to Geoffrey of Monmouth that I've mentioned there, another key figure who I believe does mention Ambrosius Aurelianus, or maybe it's quite a brief reference, Bede. So what do we hear about Ambrosius Aurelianus from Bede?
Very little, but I mean, Bede is an interesting contrast to Gildas, because you know, Bede is writing a good sort of couple of hundred years later, but he's writing from within the English perspective. So the ecclesiastical history of the English people that Bede writes, it's, you know, whereas Gildas describes the English, the Saxons, as a scourge of God, in Bede's account, they are God's chosen people, and they're being brought across the North Sea, almost like Moses-like, to the Promised Land. So there, Bede's outlook is very, very different. He mentions in passing Arthur. We get a brief sort of reference about Ambrosius. There's a sense, I mean, effectively, when he's talking about the British leaders, he plagiarises Gildas. There are certain sections where you can almost word for word what Gildas has said. Ancient writers, especially religious writers, they're not as bothered as plagiarism as we are today. You know, if a modern historian or writer takes wholesale sections of someone else's writing without crediting them, that's bad. We recognise that's bad, and that could be the end of their career. In the medieval period, that's perfectly fine. You just do that. You don't have to provide references. You don't have to say you're quoting someone else. So a lot of sections, Bede repeats what Gildas has said. So he's not providing any secondary, additional, useful information. He's just repeating verbatim what the earlier writer has said.
Well, there you go. Well, let's then move on, therefore, to Geoffrey of Monmouth. Now, how does Geoffrey represent Ambrosius Aurelianus? Take it away.
Geoffrey of Monmouth is quite a difficult character in the sense of, you know, we don't know a huge amount about him, but it's fair to say he divides opinion. Because really, since the 16th century, there's been the view that he's just made everything up. He is some kind of pro-British, pro-Welsh nationalist who creates a fantasy account of how wonderful things were here before the English arrived and provides a whole series of mythological, mythical kings going back to the time of the Trojans. You see, the British race were descended from refugees from the Trojan War.
He's the 12th century, is he writing?
He's writing in 1136. But it's clear when you look at his writings that he's using oral tradition, he's using a whole range of accounts, most of which he doesn't actually really understand the origins of. What he's really trying to do, he gathers together poems, genealogies, bits of histories, and tries to weave it into a grand narrative. It's true he is creating an account of the Britons, you know, because at the time he's living in the 1130s, the Normans are in charge of Anglo-Saxon England. But there's lots of Anglo-Saxon historians like William of Malmesbury. There's things like the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle. There are things that give the idea that the English are this great race who've come to Britain and they've had fantastic kings and monarchs. They've done all this wonderful stuff. And he's providing a counter narrative that says, hang on a minute, the Britons were doing very nicely, thank you, before the Saxons arrived. And it's quite clear, I mean, he describes as magical events, there are giants and dragons, and he builds on what other writers have done before him. But when you look at his accounts, it is very clear there are a number of historical figures which are there, and there's almost like there are versions that are quite clearly have originated from the British perspective. So when he describes the invasion of Julius Caesar in 55 and 54 BC, the only account we have of that invasion is from Julius Caesar's point of view. Geoffrey of Monmouth gives us the British perspective, and he uses a series of names that weren't actually known to him, but which archaeology has since revealed through coinage. So there are certain hints that he is using earlier accounts, albeit ones which were transmitted by word of mouth rather than being written down. Now, having said all that, and with all that sort of associated baggage, to say we have to be careful with Geoffrey of Monmouth, he does provide a detailed account of Ambrosius's life, which no earlier writer had done. Gildas just says, there's this guy, he won a battle. Bede repeats that. Geoffrey of Monmouth gives us this sense of Ambrosius's heritage. He repeats the story of the dragon prophecy in there. He gives us an account of Ambrosius as king, what he did. He gives us this idea that it's thanks to Ambrosius that Stonehenge exists as a monument. We get the earliest account of Merlin. You know, later writers have Merlin as King Arthur's wizard. In Geoffrey of Monmouth's account, Merlin and Arthur never meet. Merlin is Ambrosius's wizard. You know, so there are things in there which are important because they create, they're the beginnings of the Arthur story, they're the beginnings of a whole series of other stories. But nowhere does Geoffrey say precisely where he got his information from. So although we can say there are things there that obviously have come from verbal or oral sources, it is possible that he is also making stuff up. We just can't say. So I think we have to be very careful, but it is interesting in what he does say about Ambrosius, because one of the key events, he mentions the battles that he fought, but it's intriguing that Badon has now moved to being King Arthur's battle. Arthur is Ambrosius's nephew in this account. It's Uncle Ambrosius, who is king of Britain, who fights the Saxons, but not Badon. But he gives us this wonderful account, not just of the dragon prophecy, but this idea that because the Saxons have slaughtered a large number of British aristocrats, Ambrosius wants to create a monument to them. And he creates it on Salisbury Plain. And his wizard Merlin says, what you got to do is go to Ireland. There's a stone circle there, which is ideal. We'll go over there, we'll steal it, we'll bring it back to Salisbury Plain, we'll put it up, and it will be a monument to those who've fallen fighting the Saxons. And we get this really convoluted and rather bizarre account of the stones being brought over. And in the middle of it, Ambrosius is then crowned king, so it's part of a coronation. Now, although later archaeologists have said, well, we do know that certainly the blue stones in Stonehenge come from Wales, so there might be some evidence, you know, some sort of idea of the stones travelling some significant distance. Excavations inside Stonehenge, and I was part of the dig that Professor Timothy Darvill and Jeff Wainwright did in 2008, but we excavated a series of blue stone sockets in the interior, and they're full of late Roman material. It's quite a lot of evidence that the blue stones, as we see them today, aren't prehistoric survivals. They've been chipped at, they've been modified, they've been moved around. And although there's no proof, it will be intriguing to think that Ambrosius Aurelianus as a character, if he's, you know, I can't think of a better place to be crowned king than in the centre of Stonehenge. But what we're probably seeing, rather than the stones being brought there, they're being modified. They're being chipped, they're being changed, they're being altered, and Ambrosius is at the centre of it. There's, we can also say, you know, nearby you've got Amesbury, which translates as Ambrosius's burr. Now, we don't know whether that's a survival of the memory of Ambrosius being there, or it's some kind of back projection, or it's an invention to try and explain the name. But it's one of those key geographic locations in Britain where the name Ambrosius survives, and it's right next to Stonehenge. So there's lots of sort of intriguing evidence that links the character to the site, but it's Geoffrey of Monmouth who gives us that. And of course, we've got to be careful what he's saying.
But as you say, we have to be careful. We have to take it with a huge bucket full of salt. Exactly. But it is really interesting there that you have this potential archaeological evidence, which seems to affirm that this site was being used in this post-Roman period. You have this potential link to the name Ambrosius Aurelianus there. And then you have Geoffrey of Monmouth's accounts. And it's almost as if it's so intriguing to kind of go down that rabbit hole, isn't it? And to sort the not fact from the fiction, but to find where the elements of truth, the basis of truth, might be in his account, as you said earlier, with these Britons who were fighting against Julius Caesar, who we know were present in Britain at that time. It's really interesting, therefore, to delve into a source like Geoffrey of Monmouth to try and figure out what is the truth behind the myth in all of this?
Yes, it is. It is. I mean, I say it's, you know, intriguing that Ambrosius is linked with this part of the West Country, and that we have got. I mean, we look at Stonehenge and we think of it as a fantastic survival from the Neolithic and Bronze Age, and you tend to forget about every subsequent generation has also seen it, and they may have changed it. And there's very clear evidence in the late Roman period and the post-Roman period, someone is changing it. It would be nice if it was Ambrosius Aurelianus. That's the literary tradition, but we'll, you know, short of actually finding an inscription there that says that, you know, we're never really going to be able to prove it.
No, absolutely, fair enough. I mean, let's keep going on Geoffrey of Monmouth for a bit longer. What does he therefore say happens to Ambrosius Aurelianus?
Ambrosius Aurelianus, he's been given credit for unifying the kingdom. You know, he defeats the Saxons, he chases them up to York, he defeats them, his army defeats Hengist, who's one of the great Saxon leaders at the time. They bring peace to the kingdom. But eventually, Ambrosius Aurelianus, there is a court plot and he's poisoned and assassinated. And then his brother, Uther Pendragon, takes over. And of course, it's Uther who is the father of Arthur. So we've got this sideline of a new dynasty being created. Now, I think from what we were saying earlier, Arthur is a problematic character. And it's quite clear that the Battle of Mount Badon has been given to him. It's been taken from Ambrosius and given to Arthur. There are other things that have also been taken from other characters and given to Arthur. And I think we have to be very careful, because when we look at Arthur, in Geoffrey of Monmouth is the first person who gives Arthur a life story from conception to death. But all aspects of Arthur's story in Geoffrey has come from other people. And I think what he's done is created an ultimate Celtic superhero at the end of his book, which is drawn from all the previous characters. You know, so he's creating a fiction. And it's Arthur who lives on at the expense of Ambrosius Aurelianus. He is the real historical character we can point to and say did exist. Arthur probably didn't exist, but he's been generated out of the exploits of others.
So, I mean, let's keep on that a bit longer then. So you mentioned, and as you've said in our previous podcast about King Arthur last year, there are several figures who contribute to this creation of this Celtic superhero. So how significant is Ambrosius Aurelianus in the creation of King Arthur compared to these other figures who contribute to the figure?
Ambrosius is the only one who fits the date. So the other characters, we've got Magnus Maximus in the 4th century, we've got Arviragus or Caratacus in the 1st century AD. They provide dramatic battles. When we read stories of Arthur, there's a lot of things in there, like we've got, you know, Arthur's portrayed as a Celtic warrior, he's a berserker, he's got chariots. There's this real sense that a lot of it comes from earlier periods, from earlier sort of epic poems. Ambrosius Aurelianus is the only warrior in the post-Roman period who's fighting the Saxons, which is what Arthur does. So I think when Geoffrey of Monmouth is writing his account, he's got other sort of characters who he brings forward and it sticks into the Arthur story. But Ambrosius is there at the right time, doing the right thing,
and it's Ambrosius who fights at Badon Hill. But Geoffrey of Monmouth wants to give Badon to Arthur, his character. So he takes it from Ambrosius. But it's Ambrosius who is there at the right time in the 5th century AD. You know, he's the one who's doing the fighting. He's the one who fights the siege of Badon. He's the one who arguably might be unifying the country. He's the one who got a grand coronation at Stonehenge. But it's Arthur who obviously benefits from that because those elements are used to build him up. But it's Ambrosius who's there at the time. No other character is there fighting the Saxons in the aftermath, in the carnage of post-Roman Britain.
So apart from that, those potential links from Stonehenge, which you mentioned earlier, is there any other archaeological evidence that can give more tantalising clues about Ambrosius Aurelianus alongside the likes of Geoffrey of Monmouth?
Well, the interesting thing is that when we look at things like the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, just as a jump into another bit of evidence, but the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which we know is written, you know, at some point around about 900 AD, it's written in the Kingdom of Wessex, and it's written at the time to really create an origin story for the English, because the English are fighting the Danes at that point. So they're trying to explain how the Kingdom of Wessex came into being, and it also describes things like the Kingdom of Sussex and so on. It doesn't mention any or very few Britons by name, because it's an overtly English perspective, whereas Geoffrey of Monmouth is writing in a very overtly British perspective. But in the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, we have a character called Aella, who is the King of Sussex, who's described as being the first Bretwalda, the first overlord of Britain. Mm. And Aella is described as coming across the sea. He fights what's described as the Welsh, because the Saxons always call all the Britons Welsh. You know, it's not a geographical term. It's basically a pejorative term meaning foreigner, which is quite insulting, really. But in that sort of time, he lands on the coast, he fights a battle, and he attacks the Britons in a massive fortification and slaughters them all. And that's exactly what Ambrosius Aurelianus does. He comes across from Brittany, where he's in hiding, he lands on the coast, he fights a battle, he attacks Vortigern, and he kills everyone inside the fortress. And I think Aella is Ambrosius Aurelianus, because we know that the Saxons do that again with the Kingdom of Wessex. The founders of the Kingdom of Wessex are Cerdic and Kinric, and those are British names. So they've hijacked British kings and turned them into Saxon kings. And that's what I think Aella is. It's in Sussex, the Kingdom of Sussex. He's actually Ambrosius Aurelianus. And therefore he becomes a key figure. He becomes Arthur in British tradition. He becomes Aella in English tradition. So he's got an impact. He's obviously a major figure who does important things, but he's remembered by both sides who are fighting at that time. But we don't recognise him today. You know, he's got a major impact, but he's almost disappeared because he's evolved into something else.
He's evolved into something else, which we've gone to now. Careful about saying, you know, calling someone Welsh is an insult. You know, you're talking to someone whose surname is Hughes.
I'm not saying it's used as an insult today, but the English use it really as a sense. I mean, they use the term Welsh meaning foreigners or some of them even slaves. But it's intriguing. They land in Sussex and they fight the Welsh. That's makes sense to them, but to a writer like Geoffrey of Monmouth, who's writing in the 1130s, he sees the Saxons are fighting the Welsh. To him, it has a very distinct geographical placement, because Wales, to him, equates with what we see as Wales today. So a lot of stories of Saxons fighting Britons get transposed to Wales, because when people are writing it up, you can't have the Welsh in Sussex, but you can have them in the western part of Britain.
It's all good, amigo. Just pulling your leg. A final thing then. Let's talk about Clive Owen and the 2000 and X, whatever, whenever, whichever year it was, film King Arthur.
Yeah.
Because that King Arthur one, it almost seems as if it is, or it is, isn't it? King Arthur is the name, but it's fighting against the Saxons. You have that Roman influence there too. I don't know if there's any actual Sarmatian link in Ambrosius Aurelianus' story, but that seems to be the prime example of where the Ambrosius Aurelianus story has evolved into the Arthur story, and is sometimes Arthur is portrayed in that way.
Yeah, Arthur tends to get portrayed more recently as a late Roman general. So as exactly as, you know, Gildas describes Ambrosius Aurelianus as somebody of Roman heritage. So he's there in Roman armour, organising people in a very... He's the last gasp of Roman Britain. I'm pleased you brought that film up, because I have issues with it. I mean, it's a great bit of sort of swords and sorcery sort of thing. It's got a lot of problems in it. The Saxons land in Scotland and then they march south to Hadrian's Wall, and it has problems. But at least visually, it conveys a sort of sense of the chaos after the Romans have left. Political stability has gone, and you've got people who are probably using Roman forts as the basis of a new kingdom. You know, you've got private armies, security forces, you've got warlords and their families ensconced within the remains of Roman forts and sometimes rebuilding Iron Age hill forts. And I think visually, at least, that gives us a sense of politically what's going on, people fighting for survival. And it's later generations who look back at that and pick certain characters as their, you know, everyone likes an origin myth. Every country, every society's got an idea of where they come from, even if it's wrong. And I think people look back to Ambrosius and to Arthur and they pick and choose certain leaders and they create a mythology from that. And we've got to try and sometimes take away that mythology and go back and say, what actually is happening? What's the reality of that situation? And I think at least from the point of view of giving us a sense of what society was like, the film King Arthur is good. From a historical point of view, it's diabolically awful. But don't let me stop any of your listeners from watching it.
Let's go back to the history very quickly then. Slight tangent. Last thing before completely wrapping up. Tristan. So Tristan, there's no parallel, is there, that he's actually linked to a Romano-British hero like Arthur, is there?
Well, Tristan and Isolde.
Yeah. Sort of oh, is that the Tristan? Oh, that's the
yeah,
Isolde.
I mean, in
selfish Cornwall, tangent at the end.
You've got the so-called Tristan Stone, which is a sort of 6th, 7th century stone, which cites somebody called Drustanus. And of course, the story of Tristan and King Mark and Isolde really gets rewritten and becomes a story of King Arthur, Lancelot and Guinevere, that sort of love triangle. But it's a much, much earlier element. And certainly, I think Tristan is a Cornish hero. And he later gets written into the Arthur myth as one of Arthur's knights. But he's got an origin which is much, much earlier. And he may well be another warlord who's existing, trying to carve out a kingdom and trying to survive in 5th, 6th century Cornwall.
That's right. That's what I thought. Be that, Gildas. But there you go, Miles. Anyway, thanks for that slight tangent at the end. Last but certainly not least, you've written a book all about Ambrosius Aurelianus, King Arthur. This book, which is called
Arthur and the Kings of Britain by Amberley Publishing. It came in 2017, but we're doing a new version of that and bringing new evidence into it. But it's really an attempt to looking at Geoffrey of Monmouth and all these sources to try and see the historical reality within all these sort of later mythologies and trying to understand who Arthur was, who Ambrosius Aurelianus ultimately was.
I'm very jealous. That is such a good topic anyway. Miles, it's been an absolute pleasure. It's been wonderful to do this in person too. So it just goes to me to say thank you so much for taking the time to come back on the podcast today.
Thank you.
Well, there you go. There was Miles explaining all about Ambrosius Aurelianus and his extraordinary legacy. I love that idea, for instance, of how the red dragon of the Welsh flag, well, it originates from the figure, from the fictional stories, the later additions to the story of Ambrosius Aurelianus. It's such an interesting tale, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. Now, last thing from me, we've got a special offer ongoing at the moment on History Hit related to the Ancients podcast. Now, History Hit, it's an online subscription service dedicated just to history, documentaries, and podcasts. You have all the History Hit podcasts there, the whole stable, not just the Tudors, Gone Medieval, Betwixt the Sheets, of course the Ancients, and others. You have all of our podcast episodes there, but what's better, what's best about the History Hit versions of these podcasts is that they're ad-free. You can enjoy all these podcasts ad-free if you sign up to History Hit today with code ANCIENTS. You can enjoy 50% off your first 3 months access to History Hit. It's a bargain alongside 2 initial weeks free, completely free. So give it a test run. See if it's your cup of tea. If it's not, absolutely fair play. But it is the home for history lovers. But that's enough rambling on from me. Code ANCIENTS if you want to subscribe to History Hit today. And I'll see you in the next episode.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Ancients. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour.
Don't forget, you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code ANCIENTS at checkout.